Hi, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Cameo Launch Short Film Podcast. This week, we'll be reviewing two solid dramas. One is the very ambitious and very impactful Guest of Honor, set in Nazi Germany and written and directed by Justin Robinson. The second is a moral dilemma-based drama called Runaway, directed by Tom Ruddock. So we'll be getting to those later on in the episode. But as always, I would like to welcome our resident video wizard, George Mole.
Hello, fans of short film. How are we doing?
And George, I understand that your wizardry has now found a new home. Is that right?
It has found a new home. That is correct. I have a new role. I'm no longer living that hashtag furlough lifestyle. I'm no longer actually a direct colleague with Nigel anymore, which is quite sad, except for this podcast, which still
frankly is all
every
that
week.
Matters.
He's crying right now. You can't see the webcam, but he's actually crying. He's that upset. But that
I cried before.
Yeah.
And I will be crying after.
Right, I'm sure
now
you will.
I'm completely dry-eyed.
Well, that's all right then. But yeah, it's a working from home sort of role, so I'll be working on a laptop and I'll be joining the podcast weekly still. So that's very good news. I'm very excited about it.
Good stuff. Good stuff.
Yeah, so I'm very excited for my new role, but I recognise that other people obviously haven't been so lucky in this time. So I know that leads on quite well to our next story, doesn't it, Nigel?
It does. It does. As a lot of you will know, there have been very protracted campaigns and lobbying from theatres, music venues, arts galleries, other cultural institutions that have been, frankly, on the brink of collapse with the economic impact of the lockdown. And in the last few days, there has been an announcement from the government that they will be extending a financial lifeline of £1.57 billion to the arts sector. So at this point, there are still no firm details about how that money will be distributed and what the circumstances will be under how it's given to individual organisations. The Culture Secretary, Oliver Dowden, has said the money is intended to save, quote, crown jewel venues like the Royal Albert Hall while helping local institutions across the UK. The breakdown of how the funds will be distributed amongst UK nations is £880 million in grants and £270 million in repayable loans for cultural organisations in England. There's also a £97 million fund for Scotland, £59 million for Wales and £33 million for Northern Ireland. So how much of that money going to Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland are grants and how much is repayable loans is still not fully clear. Additionally, £100 million of targeted support is being provided for England's national cultural institutions and the English Heritage Trust alongside £120 million in capital investment to restart construction on cultural heritage projects in England that were paused due to the pandemic. Organisations such as Arts Council England, Historic England, National Lottery Heritage Fund and the British Film Institute will be involved in the decision-making process as to who receives the available grants. So to give you a bit of a snapshot as to the kind of revenue that the art sector would normally generate and what it is we're trying to save, if we just look at theatres based on figures obtained by UK Theatre, SOLT, and the Office of National Statistics in 2018, the theatre sector generated an estimated £1.2 billion in annual ticket revenue, welcomed 34 million visitors, paid £133 million in annual VAT, and employed roughly 290,000 people, and 70% of those jobs are currently at risk. There have been responses to the announcement of the financial assistance that's being provided by the government. Philippa Childs, head of BECTU, the union that supports workers across the media and entertainment industry, said, quote, "We will be scrutinising the details of this package to make sure it lives up to the real needs of our sector," end quote. Christine Payne of the Performers Union Equity said that it's important that this money doesn't just prop up venues. So, quote, "If this investment does not reach creative workers, the actors, dancers, stage management, singers, variety artists, directors, designers, choreographers and many other highly skilled workers in our talent base, we risk the diversity and success of the wider creative industries, worth £112 billion to the economy," end quote. So there's a mixture of how this is being received. I think there's quite a lot of trepidation in there, even people who have been outwardly very happy about this, and I think there are a lot of people that are very happy and very grateful and very relieved about this announcement. But even those more positive responses have still got a hint of caution to them. Dame Judi Dench has said, quote, "It'll probably be spread very thinly, but nevertheless, we're all incredibly grateful that it's come at this time." Julia Fawcett, the chief executive of the Lowry in Salford, has said the announcement of funding is welcome news, but, quote, "This lifeline will come too late for some organisations who have already been forced to close their doors for good or made valued employees redundant," end quote. So at the time of recording, it's not been made clear as to when these venues would be able to open their doors again and what the restrictions would be when they do. As such, there's still no clarity for many of these organisations, and with no way to plan, many will have to proceed with redundancies, job cuts and closures anyway. According to an article from The Guardian, Nuffield Southampton Theatres announced that it will be closing permanently after failing to agree a deal with its administrators. National Theatre has said that because it is still unclear what level of support will be available to them, then, quote, "some reduction in our workforce will be unavoidable." So the National Theatre is expected to shed some 400 jobs, including 250 front-of-house workers who won't be kept on beyond August. So with all of that going on, still quite a lot of uncertainty despite this 11th-hour lifeline. My questions are, number one, is this the lifeline that the arts sector needed, or is it too little too late? Number two, how much support are freelancers likely to see, given the amount of the workforce that a lot of these venues depend on, particularly music venues and theatre productions as well? And three, while this will support, quote, crown jewel venues, will this help smaller, less high profile organisations that, while not well known, are still vital not just to the arts, particularly independent artists, but as focal points for the development of young people in communities across the country? So I'm going to lay that one out to you, George. Feel free to try and solve this problem for us in the next 10 minutes. Off you go.
No worries. I will do my best. I will do my best to parrot exactly what you said and what the BBC article said in a very slightly more stupid voice, effectively. Basically, yeah, I think it is too little too late. So that's a yes straight away. It is too little too late. But at least it's a start. You can't be unhappy because, well done, something's happened. But yeah, I do fear for people from economically deprived backgrounds. Are they going to get enough money? Are they going to get the funding they need? Are they going to be able to keep going? Are we going to get loads of... this is going to have a knock-on effect for years, right? Because so many people now are not going to carry on with their art. They're not going to produce. They're not going to be working on it. So I fear for these people, like, from the music point of view as well. I've heard, you know, one of my favourite bands, Foals, said, you know, if they started in the year that the lockdown happened, then they wouldn't have been a band. It wouldn't have happened whatsoever. Same for so many up-and-coming actors and freelancers and people just front of house at theatres. They haven't got a livelihood and they're not going to get the support. They're just going to be made redundant. But all they know is working in a theatre. They'll have to go back. At least the pubs are open, so it's a start. But yeah, I feel for them. I do worry, especially with the comedy circuit. If all these small clubs close down, then that's a lot of work for a lot of people gone. And we do, as it says in the article, we have one of the best comedy circuits in the world because we have all of these little ones. And I know up-and-coming comedians can literally go from one gig, walk up the road to another pub or another venue, and then carry on. And it's how they can hone their craft. And so many people who are there at those pubs are enjoying it as well. So if you think that's going to have such a knock-on effect.
What I think this has really highlighted is how fragile the whole art sector was in the first place.
Yeah.
How unsupported it was, how great a job it was doing at supporting itself as well. I mean, if you look at something like the Edinburgh Fringe and the Edinburgh Film Festival and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
If you go into Edinburgh when those festivals are happening, then you'll see loads of small venues just kind of coming out of the woodwork. You'll see loads of people going to just finding all of these sort of tucked away, out of the way places that normally wouldn't see massive amounts of footfall, but they're known to the arts community as a great place to perform. And those won't be on, I imagine, probably won't be on the list of places that the government's looking to help or support, but they will have been hit and hit hard. As a small venue, you're not going to have massive amounts of revenue to fall back on if you can't open for a week, a month, 2 months, 3 months, four months. And, you know, they rely on independent artists coming to use their space and bringing crowds with them and paying rental and all that kind of stuff, as well as being able to, you know, do all the usual things like sell alcohol or food or whatever else. And, you know, those types of venues are the lifeblood of people who are just starting out. So even if you somehow manage to protect what's there now, it completely decimates artists who are starting out. Because a lot of the time, when you start out volunteering, you start out as an intern.
Yeah, it's all unpaid work.
So yeah, there's loads of unpaid work. But you do it in loads of those small types of venues, and you get to know the community through being in those venues and running into the same people, and you work your way up slowly but surely. And it's a hard slog anyway under the best of circumstances, just because there's no sort of commercial infrastructure that allows for a person to get a job at X level and expect to work their way up to Y level within a year or 2 years or whatever. So a lot of it is reliant on just being able to stick with it. And a lot of the time when you see people who have made it, people from the UK who have made it as actors or singers or whatever, quite a lot of the time they come from quite privileged backgrounds anyway. They come from backgrounds where they have the finances to not be paid from their art for however long, for years and years and years. And a lot of people who do that circuit at Edinburgh Fringe or anywhere else don't have that luxury. They just don't have it. And for the venues that they rely on to now no longer have that support and are quite seriously looking at going under, that's devastating. That's devastating to the future of art for this entire country. For all of the talent that we're hoping to produce, that I don't think it can be overstated how serious this could be for British culture as a whole. Despite the fact that a lot of the funding is very England-centric, there's a lot that goes on in Wales, there's a lot that goes on in Scotland and Northern Ireland that, you know, that they're given, what, 33, 50-odd million pounds as opposed to the hundreds of millions being poured into England as well. So it's a disproportionate distribution of the funds that have been put forward in the first place. And it wouldn't surprise me if, especially given the quote about the whole Crown Jewels venue thing, that a lot of them do end up going to the symbolic venues and the restoration of those older buildings. And a lot of the less known places just kind of fall by the wayside, even though that's where a lot of the artists kind of depend on it. These guys aren't depending on the Royal Albert Hall.
No, you know, they're dreaming of being at the Albert Hall one day. Of course, everyone does. And that's such a staple. And I'm sure it would be such a shame. And Twitter would be rampant if we said we're shutting down the Albert Hall to fund everything else. Because, of course, it's heritage, it's history. But, we need all these small venues. Otherwise, there will be no art in the Albert Hall eventually. It will only be rich people. And do you know what? I like Daniel Blake. I think we need some more poor people making good media. And that's not going to happen, unfortunately, for quite a while, I'd say.
Yeah. I mean, as they say, the devil is in the detail. It may well be that that they're planning on scrutinising those particular sectors in those particular areas and making a certain amount of funding available to them. It would surprise me, but maybe it will happen. I don't know. But my hope is that artists and venues of that nature will, in as much as they can, keep making themselves heard. That it will be made quite clear as to how they can apply for this funding and how much of it they will actually be entitled to as well. But in as much as you can, guys, if the option is there to buy memberships at your local theatres or your music venues or your arts venues in your community, if you can do it, do it. Obviously, it's a difficult time for a lot of people, so obviously there's no pressure, and you shouldn't feel pressured to pay for these things if you can't physically afford it. But if the opportunity is there, then please do try and support them, because these guys are the next generation of how we reflect each other's stories in this country and our experiences in this country as well. And I think it's important that that gets preserved. But moving on to ways of reflecting each other's stories, let's get into our short film reviews for this week. So, first up is Guest of Honor, written and directed by Justin Robinson. And this is about a devout Nazi who is overseeing a group of taste testers for Hitler. So this focused on an area of the Nazi regime that isn't often spoken about, but I found just fascinating, is that there was this practice of getting people, in this case, a group of women, to taste Hitler's food because he was so paranoid about being assassinated. So these people would just sit down and eat what could be their last meal, all in the sort of greater service of the Reich. And the way that this particular story is portrayed, the thing that stood out to me is that there's a real sense of how hollow people are made by idolatry. So you have these women who are the taste testers who are putting their lives on the line, essentially. And then you have the German officer, Fritz, played by Silvio Wolf Busch. His whole sense of self-worth. I mean, he comes in and he's basically in command and he's telling these people that they need to eat this food, but he's not forcing them, he's not shouting at them. He's basically propping them up almost as heroes. As heroes of the Reich, of heroes of Germany, people that, you know, that will be looked up to and all this kind of thing. Just the way he addresses them as if, you know, they're just these amazing people. The reality, obviously, is that the Reich doesn't think anything more of them than we need some warm bodies to make sure that Hitler doesn't get poisoned, so just get these guys. But the way that they are sort of forced into doing it is almost through reverence, which I found just fascinating. And the sort of command that this guy has over these women is all kind of built on the fact that his status is given to him by the Reich and by extension by Hitler. And his sort of sense of self-worth is only as strong as what somebody else thinks of him, what his fellow officers think of him, what his superiors think of him, and ultimately what Hitler thinks of him. And his power ultimately is ceded completely to them, and they can take it away at any time. And then on the flip side to that, you have Anna, played by Stephanie Butler, who's one of these taste testers. And she just has this sort of quiet resolve in that she is not going to allow her life to be sacrificed by somebody else. She knows that she is worth nothing to these people, but she's worth something to her. And it kind of segues into this very covert battle of wits between Anna and Fritz as to whether or not she's going to survive this whole process. And it's really, really interesting. A lot of this is very psychological, and a lot of it is done in the eyes as well, particularly in the case of Anna. Stephanie Butler does a fantastic job of conveying a lot of her thought process just with a look. That is a very, very difficult thing to pull off, to telegraph to the audience what you're thinking without saying it is just fantastic. On the flip side, you've got Fritz, who is just very bombastic and he's very overbearing, but you can see, you can almost pinpoint the weakness in him, and you can almost see Anna trying to zero in on it, and whether or not she can may determine whether or not she survives the story. So yeah, I thought it was, from that perspective, very, very well done. George, what were some of your thoughts on it?
Yeah, from my point of view, I thoroughly enjoyed it. I thought it was really well done. We've got two perfectly short films this week, both 10 minutes exactly. And Guest of Honor, I wanted more, but I didn't want more. I was perfectly happy with sort of how it ended, and I thought, wow, what a brilliant film from start to finish. What I did like was what they didn't show you, what they did keep from you, what wasn't shown, what wasn't said, that actually kept you in suspense by the end of the film. You know, you might have been trying to guess things or guess how it's going to go. We've all seen Inglourious Basterds. Well, I mean, we also all know history. We know what happens at the end, technically. Spoiler alert, I don't know if you know this, but the Nazis did not win. So you have that going in, sure. But either way, Anna's journey is so brilliant, and the performance is so good. You're so right about the eyes. I literally wrote that down here. I just drew two little eyes on my notepad. I was just staring at her, and you can just, there's so much that isn't said that you can sort of work out from her performance, which I thought was brilliantly done.
And there's a lot there in terms of authenticity as well. The set design, costume design, the fact the whole thing is in German as well.
Yeah.
And they're not all German actors. I think the actor who plays Fritz, Silvio Wolfbusch, he is German-born, but I think he has lived the majority of his life in the States.
I was going to say, because his accent is basically spot on from what I remember from studying German at school many years ago, so it's very believable either way.
The performances from everybody, and it's more than just these two people in the film as well. There are, as we mentioned, the other taste testers, there are other Nazi officers, and every bit of dialogue just sounds very, very authentic. And the visual style of it as well, the film is in black and white, and it's also quite high contrast. And because of the starkness of the image, it kind of mirrors the moral absolutes, the two ends of the spectrum that Anna and Fritz are actually on, in terms of self-actualization and self-worth and what each will be willing to do to achieve the thing they actually want. Effectively, what she's trying to accomplish is survival.
Yes.
And she wears it on her. Absolutely. In a way, Fritz is trying to accomplish the same thing, but rather than it being a case of, I need to do this to survive, it's, I need to do this to enable these people to give me my survival, to give me my self-worth, my life, my recognition.
His pride. His pride relies on them.
Relies on her. I just love the dynamic that they set up.
Absolutely.
I think there's been kind of a running theme with the stuff that we've been reviewing lately, with being put off food.
Yes. I had a very busy day today.
And now this.
I don't know why. I think because we've watched a few comedy ones recently and like last week, and it's all been very nicely. I thought, do you know what? I'll have enough time. I'm going to eat two slices of pizza that I've got for dinner as I watch these films. I should not have done that. I thought I would have learned by now. But no, yeah, you're right. That is a running theme. Don't eat food when you watch short films.
Hmm. But yeah, I mean, the threat just seems to be everywhere all the time. And that's kind of reflected in the portrait of Hitler, which is on the wall for the majority of the film as well, just watching over them. He is both threat and salvation, depending on who you are in any given scene.
Depending on which character you're in, which character's eyes you're looking through. And I love behind it as well, you've got this thick, loud, Imperial March almost sounding music, classical music behind every time you see the sort of Hitler portrait, and the music as a whole really rises behind it, and it's powerful. And it is literally both of those sides of the coin. I love that.
Yeah, the score was fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. Kyle McHouston was the person that composed that score, and it just comes in so hard at certain points. It's almost on that John Williams level.
Yeah,
it's not quite John Williams. I mean, John Williams is the pinnacle of greatness when it comes to music scores, so it's not there, but it's approaching it just in terms of how powerful it is, just in those key moments of the film. I think a fantastic job was done on that, and it contrasts nicely with the moments of silence as well. It really allows those moments of silence to hit you. So it's a fantastic job, fantastic film, and a definite recommendation. And moving on to our second film, Runaway, which is written and directed by Tom Ruddock, and centres on a expectant father named George, coincidentally, who is looking to escape his demons after a car accident. So we open the film on a voice message of our main character, George's partner, telling him that she's going into labor and she's about to have their baby. And that is contrasted with George running in, looking absolutely just destroyed and scared, and suddenly starts packing a suitcase. And even though you associate throwing things into a bag when you know that there's a baby on the way with, I'm about to jump in the car and then go to the hospital, you know that's not where he's going. And then as it kind of unfolds, you realize what he's done, and in walks his friend. And the bulk of the story is talking through the moral dilemma of facing up to his actions in the face of the turn his life was supposed to have taken today, and the turn that he's actually going to take One of the things about this film that stood out for me is how unshowy and unflashy it is. It's just very, very straight to the point. And it's wise enough, and Tom Ruddock is smart enough to allow the premise and the sort of the gut-wrenching nature of it to just speak for itself. It doesn't need sort of flashy editing and cool shots and distorted sound or anything like that to underscore those emotional points. He just allows it to speak for itself. He kind of allows it to rest on the shoulders of the actors who are at the heart of the story. Jack Brett Anderson as George and Lucien Labiscount as Henry. And I don't want to say chemistry. It's not exactly chemistry, but the way that they have to engage in this moral argument is just so compelling to just watch. Their performances are absolutely fantastic. And it really keeps you rooted to the story, wondering what he's going to do and how it's all going to actually end up. I was thoroughly immersed in this one right through to the end. George, what did you think of it?
Yeah, absolutely. The first thing I wrote down was just fantastic performances. I mean, I was absolutely enamored, especially Lucien Labiscount. Both of them were great, but it was just so believable, which is what made this hit even more after the credits rolled. I was like, I'm not ready to watch the next short film. I don't want to stay in this world, but I'm here. Like, it has stayed with me, definitely. It was just so believable. There's just the small sort of micro moments in their performance, just the stupid things that you probably remember from drama when you did it at school, but just looking down and to the side and then coming up again. And these micro moments are happening literally in seconds in the performance. And it just seems so real. It's exactly how I would assume someone to act in this moral dilemma that our two characters face. And I just thought, yeah, performance, absolutely brilliant. The sound was great. The sound design with the diegetic sounds coming from this stereo at the start, which it turns out were all recorded, you see from the credits at the end, from different actors who've recorded all those things. And then the ending song, which sounds just like, if anyone's a fan of the band Bon Iver, it sounded just like them. I had to check. It's actually a friend of Tom Ruddock, I'm pretty sure. A friend who's a musician who'd written it. But yeah, I just stayed there in the credits.
Written for the film, yeah.
Yeah, just stayed there in the credits listening to this beautiful music and feeling quite quite sad.
Yeah. It's just given the nature of the story, of the premise, there's no chance of a happy ending, basically. I don't think it's a spoiler to say that. But you know, it is cathartic in the way that it's done. And you do really feel George's fear and how he's basically trapped. I mean, there are so many things at play. There's the fear, there's the guilt, there's just from all sides
shock.
As well.
The pure shock. You can tell that these both characters are going through shock. You can tell that it's clear. Yeah.
Yeah. And on top of that as well, there's the intermittent voice of George's partner, as she keeps telling him that, basically keeps updating
over
what's happening.
Yeah.
Over voicemail, yeah. And George's mum at one point as well.
Yeah.
And just the confusion and the fear and the anger and the frustration just all comes out. And, you know, these are two people whose faces you don't see at all in the film. I think it's fantastic in that they kept it really, really simple.
Yeah.
And that they made it a vehicle for performance, for human emotion, effectively.
Yeah.
And they just let that do the storytelling.
Yeah.
And it does it brilliantly. Does it brilliantly. Another firm recommendation there.
Definitely.
I think there's two solid 10-minute films to sink your teeth into. The links for the reviews of both films are in the episode notes for this podcast. Additionally, there are links relating to our story about the $1.57 billion fund for the arts as well. If you want to read up a bit more about that, just follow those links and get a bit more info. But also, if you are an artist, if you're a freelancer or somebody who's been affected by those events, then by all means get in touch with us. Find us on socials at Cameo Launch on Instagram, Twitter and Facebook, and just let us know how you've been affected, how you hope the funds will be spent. what it is you need in terms of support as well. And hopefully we'll be able to share some of those experiences and shed a bit of light on what's happening to a lot of people in that position as well. And if you are looking for more short films that we've reviewed, then head over to our site, cameolaunch.com, and check those reviews out there. Each review carries a link to the film itself, so you can watch each one as you read through it. If you are a filmmaker and you're hoping to have your film reviewed, and if you want it to appear on this podcast as well as on our website, then please do submit to the Cameo Launch Showcase on Film Freeway. So that's filmfreeway.com/Cameo Launch Showcase. And if successful, if selected, then we'll be talking about it on this podcast. But until then, George, thank you very, very much for your thoughts on both the events that have been happening out in the world, for the films that that you've reviewed as well. And congratulations once again on your new role.
Thank you very much. Pleasure as always, and look forward to doing the same again next week.
Absolutely. And in the meantime, everybody, please do stay safe out there. Look after each other, and we hope to see you on the next one. Thanks very much.